What is going on, Redemption Church? So glad to be with you this morning. I got to give a personal confession about this series and the title and the video. When I first came up with it, I was a little nervous because I had this moment of like, am I rewriting the Bible a little with this? Like, you know, because the prayer is, may your kingdom come, may your will be done on earth as it is in Duval, and I are in heaven. Oops. All right, so this is bad already. All right, so I had this moment of already messing with stuff more, and yet what I like about this, aside from the fact that I can't remember the Bible, is I love the fact that it kind of puts the weight on us, right? Like, it's not just a prayer that we pray that the kingdom would come on earth as it is in heaven, but rather it's this also responsibility. Like, hey man, I want to make sure that as I live in my community, I am actualizing that prayer. That I feel this sense of need to do that in the space that I'm living in, and that we as a church feel the need to do that as well. And so for me, that's why I really kind of dug the title. And today, because this whole series is really just about who we are as a church, right? Our vision, our values, our vibe, the stuff that makes us tick, our what, how, who, all of that's in there. And so today's topic, I really dig because it actually goes all the way even to the very beginning of our existence as a church. It's one that's really dear to my heart. And so because of that, I'm just going to get right underway with prayer, and then we're going to jump right into stuff because I do think it's a very important topic for all of us to ponder, and then from that, all of us to live. So let's go ahead and pray together, and we'll get underway. Jesus, I thank you that you call us to action, not simply to thought, not simply to validation or verification. You call us to a faith that then has these works behind it that are designed to show you to the world and to love you by loving the world around us. I mean, I think about that when John writes that in his letter. He's like, hey, if you say you love God, but you don't love the people around you, do you really love God? Like, you put this pressure in there that says to love you is to love others, because in loving others, we're loving how you love others, and we're doing it in your name. And so I pray that as we're looking at that today, that we will be very, like, up in the front of our seats and kind of pondering in our mind, like, how do we do this better? How can we do this more? How can we enjoy the joy of loving people around us? And so, again, we look to you to guide us and teach us in those things, and I pray that from that there is excitement and that there is creativity in how we seek to do that. So we look to you, Jesus, today to guide us and show us in your good name. Amen. So I don't know about you. I would guess this is probably true. I know it's true for me, that there are certain individuals that they just do things that I'm just drawn into because they managed to find a way to do things that seemed impossible, and they made the impossible possible. And one of those persons, which I never met personally, unfortunately they just passed away this last year, was a man named Tim Keller. And some of you may know that name. He was a pastor, theologian, writer in Manhattan. And he did something that I look at and I go, I don't know how that's done. He planted a church in Manhattan from scratch. And over the course of many years, it grew into a mega church. And here's what's weird. It did that without fog machines and fancy lights. He dressed in like tweed jackets and looked like a professor. Like, he didn't fit any of the mold of like mega church pastor. And what's incredible about it is he actually came from a small country church to the great metropolis of Manhattan and went from nothing to thousands of people. Now, what I loved about Keller, and I think why in some ways I would say he's one of my kind of distant mentors, is because he did everything in this third way kind of model. He's like, I'm not going to go far this way. I'm not going to go far that way. I'm going to do this third space kind of thing. And so he spoke with whimsy, but with biblical conviction and heart. He understood culture and spoke to the culture of a metropolis like Manhattan in such a way that he took people from radically diverse backgrounds, right? With all kinds of different thoughts and political ideas and values and everything else. But he saw them come together in the name of Jesus to do a thing that everybody said, that can't be done. Not in that city. No way, no how. In fact, I would even say that Tim Keller, to me, has been the greatest voice of the Christian faith, probably since C.S. Lewis. Like, I really look at him in that light. And what I love about what he did toward the end of his time is he kind of took pieces and parts of everything that he had learned planting this church, and he put it into a textbook. It's this book right here. It's called Center Church. Nobody run out and buy this. you will fall asleep in 5 seconds, all right? In other words, it's not like a, ooh, page turner, oh, this is, but if you're a pastor and you're trying to figure out how to do contemporary, culturally minded, but loving Jesus ministry, this is a great roadmap. And so for me, as we've kind of worked through the things of the church over the course of years, Keller became a voice. I would say that Keller's fingerprints are on us, right, as a community of faith. And on the topic of the day, I want to share with you just a little chunk out of his book because it captures, I think, the heart of what we're trying to do and I think the heart of what he did. He said, in the West, that's here in the United States, maybe a little bit of Great Britain, but not the same as the East and the South, but in the West, two sets of ministry concerns, one emphasizing word and the other emphasizing deed, one focusing on proclamation and the other on service, have been split off from one another into rival political and denominational factions for nearly a century. He says, conservative ministry stresses the importance of personal morality and approves of calling people to conversion through evangelism and the preaching of the gospel. Liberal ministry stresses social justice and rejects overt calls to convert others. But Jesus calls his disciples to both gospel messaging and to gospel neighboring. The two concerns must always go together. Jesus himself came both preaching the word and healing and feeding. I would argue, as would Keller, that all of that is gospel. All of that is gospel. He says, the final kingdom will be one of justice for all. Christians can faithfully proclaim the gospel both through words and deeds of compassion and justice, serving the material needs of people around us, even as we call them to faith in Jesus. In addition to the theological harmony of these concerns, they also go together practically. In some ways, gospel neighboring is gospel messaging. Loving deeds of service to someone, regardless of their race or faith, are always an attractive testimony to the truth and motivational power of the gospel. The church's ministry to the poor makes great sense as a corporate witness to the community of Christ's transforming love, and it's an important plausibility structure for the preaching of the gospel. So in other words, when he says, hey man, when you're loving your community tangibly, honestly, authentically, monetarily, whatever it is, when you do that, people go, there must be something to this Jesus and what he said. It gives it plausibility. From this, he goes on to articulate three ways in which it's achieved. He says it's to love a neighbor, it's to serve with mercy, and it's a call to do justly or justice in our world. And really, when I look at today, that's precisely what I'm trying to get at, right? Keller, I think, says it well. I know that was a lot, but I think he says it well. And so far in our series, we've been talking about the values that we have as a church. Like, what are the things that we're really trying to do in our community that is our authentic DNA? From that, we said, hey, man, as we're trying to help people believe that life is, in fact, better with Jesus, doing it his way, in his tone, with his heart, is better for everybody around us, right, including ourselves, we've said what we do in our value system is we seek to be like Jesus, we err on the side of grace, we take the Bible seriously, we seek to encourage that everybody sweeps, and then today, we seek to do things for the good of the city. We seek to do things for the legitimate, sincere good of our community. And the place I want to start today is a return to our reading this morning, right? So great passage out of Jeremiah 29. He says, I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call on me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all of your heart. Now, this passage is very popular, right? And I think there's probably many of us that have looked at this and said, hey, this is kind of like a life verse for me, especially when things are hard, when the current problems or crisis seems a bit dire. We kind of run to this passage and go like, yes, that's right. I know that God's still got a future for me. He's got plans for me. He's looking out for me. I don't have to lose hope. He's my hope. I think that's awesome. But if you get back into the sandals of Jeremiah when he writes it, and the world in which he kind of spoke these words into, you have to understand that their circumstance was really, really rough, right? Here's a quick history lesson about it. So there was the nation of Israel, and for a handful of its early kings, it was unified. But after Solomon, it fractures and divides into northern and southern. Eventually, the northern tribes, all 10 of them, are kind of punked by the Assyrians, taken into captivity, really never to come back again. it leaves this last remaining two tribes, the region of Judah, the people of Judah, or basically it's kind of like the kingship of Judah, is still holding on for a while, about another 100 years, until Nebuchadnezzar rolls in with the Babylonians, right? And says, all right, now you all are punk too. And so they are beaten militarily, they were removed from their land physically, and they are in very rough space, all because they've been unfaithful to God. And so they have suffered a military defeat, but then with that, anybody that had skill, anybody that had ability that was there as the last remaining group of Judah, they're taken to the capital of Babylon to serve its function. So Jeremiah 29, before he gets into, I know the plans I have for you, it starts with the problem. And this is the problem. It says, Jeremiah wrote a letter from Jerusalem to the elders and the priests and the prophets and to all the people who have been exiled into Babylon, to the king, the queen mother, the court officials, other officials, the craftsmen, and the artisans. They had all been deported away from Jerusalem and there to Babylon. Again, you have to understand what's going on in their world, right? If you're a Star Trek nerd like me, like Babylon is the Borg, right? They're assimilated. And so what they're going to be required to do as Israelites is go to a pagan land to serve a pagan king and to help that king and his pagan land succeed. You've got ability, skills, you're craftsmen, you're artisans. You know how to deal with political things, right? We need your power, we need your knowledge, and we need your skill so that you can make us better. You can make us stronger. You can make us a formidable foe that nobody can beat. This is why even when you read the story of Daniel, that's what Daniel does, right? He's like this Jewish kid that's really smart, good at some things, and they're like, awesome, we're going to use you to advance our cause. Like, imagine if that happened to us today. Like, let's say the Russians invade or the Chinese invade, and they're like, now we're going to bring you to Beijing or we're going to bring you to Moscow, and your skills are going to be used to help us get better and stronger. I mean, that would be a tough sell, right? I mean, what do you do when a pagan empire is requesting this and requiring this of you? Do you resist? Do you revolt? Do you refuse? Like, what do you do? Well, I'm sure they want to know. And so Jeremiah is writing this letter, and this is what God is telling Jeremiah to say. And so it starts in verse 3. This is what Jeremiah's letter said to all these people who were taken into Babylon. It says, this is what the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of Israel, says to all the captives that he has exiled to Babylon from Jerusalem. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'm sitting there and I'm hearing this out loud for the first time and I hear the phrase, the Lord of heaven's armies, I start to get a little excited. Like, ooh, that's right. Our God's got an army. And we're God's people, and we're enslaved by people that are not God's people. Oh, this is getting good. Our God's ready to fight for us. He's ready to go to war. He wants to go ahead and crack some skulls. He's going to open up a can of whoop wrath, man, on the Babylonians. Let's go, baby. When you hear army, you're thinking warfare. You're thinking of fight. So they're probably going, what's he going to tell us next? Do we stockpile weapons? Do we plan an insurgency? Do we weave our way into the political structure of Babylon and we try to figure out how to be saboteurs in this environment, right? Like they're the ancient Mossad or something like that. Like, what are we supposed to do? What does the Lord of heaven's armies say for them to do? Verse 5, build homes and plan to stay, right? He's like, plant gardens, eat the food that they produce, marry and have children, and then find spouses for them so that you may have many grandchildren. Multiply and do not dwindle away. Just honestly, you're thinking like, we just got punked. Now we're here helping these pagans, and then God tells us, stay put. Right? Chill out. And notice the progression in that. It's not just like put down roots and build a house. He's like, I want you guys to get married. So you young Israelites that are just showing up to Babylon, find somebody, get married, have babies, okay? And then let those great babies grow up till they need to be married and find them spouses. You're like, so this is gonna be a while. Hopefully they're gonna give you grandkids. Now we're talking multi-generational, serving pagans, looking out for pagans, helping the pagans thrive, right? It raises the question then, at least if they're gonna be there during that time doing that thing, how should they live in an ungodly land? Should they be sectarian? Like, we're just going to be like the Jewish equivalent of the Amish. We're not going to have any power. We're not going to do anything with the people. We're going to just do our own thing. We're going to be over here. We're going to seclude ourselves. Or maybe it's not sectarian, but maybe it's being contrarian. We'll be here, but we're going to be a thorn in their side the whole time. We're going to critique their culture. We're going to criticize what they do. We're going to impede all of their actions. We're going to talk about how evil the Babylonians are all the time, right? What do we do in this context? Well, here's what God says. He says, as you're staying there and you're having kids and grandkids and you're doing all of this, work for the peace and prosperity of the city where I sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, for its welfare will determine your welfare. Can I tell you, I love this? I love this, right? He's like, I know you guys are angry. I know you're hurt. I know you feel cheated, but you got yourselves into this too. But now that you're there and you're kind of hanging out for a while, I want you to diffuse peace in the land of the pagans. That's what I want you to do. I want you to do things that helps their community, their nation, and their empire actually thrive. Yes, I know, they're pagan. Help them out. He says, pray for and seek the welfare of all in the city. And he says, because ultimately you have a symbiotic relationship. They're going to rely on you, and you're going to rely on them. They're going to need you, you're going to need them. I want you to look out for them, and when you do that, they're going to look out for you. Right? This is the heart that God has for his exiles. And here's why I love this, just as a personal note. So redemption started almost 13 years ago. So this September, late September, early October will be 13 years. And when we started, we had nothing. We had nothing, right? We had no equipment. We had no instruments. We certainly had no building, right? There's a whole story to it, but we had nothing. You know what it meant? We were flushed into the city. We were reliant on the city. And then the city says, you know what? Hey, we want to help you out. So we meet with the school. They're like, yes, you can meet in the school. We didn't know 13 years later we'd still be meeting in the school, but we're right on the precipice, right? We're right on the precipice of something different, right? But we didn't know that. So like, I remember the first few weeks, it was like coffee shops and wine bars and pubs were our offices. The very first Sunday, and for the next three after that, we didn't have a drum set. The divey biker bar in town. I know you all know Duval Tavern now. Not always Duval Tavern. Used to be Sketchy Weird Tavern, right? Sketchy Weird Tavern said, you can use our drums for the first few weeks. They were the first organization or group or restaurant in town to put up our poster. Hey, come check out Redemption Church, right? 9:30 a.m. or whatever it was. You know, like they were that. The second was the tap room with Eric that owns the grill. Oh yeah, man, we'll advertise your church here in our pub. Why not? It's great. Right? The city just opened up to us. Even still, man, like we're without offices and stuff. Like the fire station has become where our board meets and we have staff meetings sometimes, coffee shops, different places. I mean, you name it. Like the city just opened itself up for us and provided for us, loved us, cared for us in our space. They didn't always have to agree with us to say, yeah, we'll open the school to you. Yeah, we'll open our business to you. I remember years ago when I first started a relationship with Eric over there at the grill, I came to him and I said, dude, I know the tap room is open on Monday nights, but not the restaurant. Could I use the restaurant for a thing called Theology on Tap? Right? Yeah, somebody remembers it, right? And he goes, what is that? I go, well, I want us to drink beer and talk about theology. And he goes, you're the pastor of the church across the street, right? I said, yeah. And he goes, you know, you oppose my liquor license over there. And I said, I know, we want to use it now. Is that okay? You know, change of people, you know, or whatever else, you know. But that relationship grew, right? And so then he's like, yeah, this must be awesome. You know, so it's just things like that. It's for all of that that the very first week of Redemption Church, we had two mottos. Church without walls, which is weird because we're about to have walls. And the other was do things for the good of the city. And it's endured. And if you talk to people in this town, Christian and non-Christian, it is kind of the thing they know about us. Like we've been succeeding in that cause and that purpose. So we want to continue to do that. Now, we're not like ancient Israelites facing a mighty power of Babylon, but in a weird sort of way, the New Testament uses that language for us. Like, for example, if you read the book of Revelation, right, it talks about the fact that the whole world is basically Babylon. Like, still, it kind of has that architecture to it. The United States, Babylon, Russia, Babylon, China, Babylon, all the places are Babylon, right? They are. And in Babylon, we are called to be exiles. And this is something that Peter talks about in his first letter. He's like, if you follow Jesus, you're an exile. Starting in verse 1, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are chosen exiles of the dispersion. This is kind of a lot of Christian Jews that have been forced out of their lives into new lives. From this, he writes, God the Father knew you and chose you long ago, and his Spirit has made you holy. That word holy is going to become important moving forward. He says, you must be holy in everything that you do, just as God who chose you is holy. Now, that word holy, it doesn't really stand alone. Like what we tend to do in shorthand as Christians is use it as a synonym for like morality or godliness or purity or whatever. But technically, the word is a little bit more ubiquitous. It was used both of pagan cultures as well as Hebrew or Christian cultures. And so it kind of goes across the board. And if you really kind of distill it down in the simplest fashion, it simply means to be different or other or uncommon or to stand out from the norm. And so in Hebrew, it's kodesh. In Greek, it's hagias or kadash rather. So these words were used in both Old and New Testament context, used again in outside religious context, inside religious context. For example, if a building was different than other buildings, it was holy. It was just uncommon from the norm, right? So it would be used for religious purposes or non-religious purposes, which then tells us that when we throw this word out there, what it needs is context and contrast. What it needs is context and contrast. In other words, you go, well, whatever is norm, I should try to figure out what would be abnormal from the norm, and then how does that then equate with what Jesus is calling me to do or us to do or whatever else? That's how you figure out kind of this idea of holiness. Now, a few years ago, we did something, I don't know if it was smart or dumb. We went through the book of Leviticus, right, on a Sunday morning, right, for weeks and weeks and weeks. And still to this day, my top three favorite series, Leviticus is inside the top three for me personally. I loved it. And I loved it because, again, it's something most people never do. But I also love it because, again, this idea of holy comes up 150 times in Leviticus, more than any book of the entire scripture. Like, it's just chocked full. So if it's saying it that many times, you're trying to figure out then, well, what is holy in relationship to all these occurrences? And when we distilled it down and we tried to find a functional definition, not just like it's uncommon or whatever, just to find a functional definition, what we concluded from the book of Leviticus is that holiness is love displayed in mercy and justness. To truly be holy is to display love and mercy and justice. That is the heartbeat of the whole thing, right? And so if I take that and I overlay it with who we are, and I'm gonna build this case in a minute a little bit more, but if I overlay it with who we are, this was the statement I wrote this week just to try to take everything I've said and put it into a chunk. I wrote, what RC seeks to do for the good of the city is to live as exiles, seeking our city's welfare by standing out from the norm through love displayed in mercy and justice. All of this exists to embody both gospel neighboring and gospel messaging, pulling my man Tim Keller into that whole thing. And so gospel neighboring is displaying to our city, we love you, we care about your welfare, we're concerned with your needs, we actually care about the whole, not just our little subpart. And then we're doing that in the spirit of gospel messaging. This is who Jesus is. This is what Jesus did. This is what he came to do. He came to deal with our sin. He came to bring us back to him. He came to redeploy us for his purposes, to advance his kingdom so that the kingdom could come in Duval as it is in heaven. Like, this is the heartbeat of all of this stuff. It's because of that, man, that's why we are seeking the peace of Duval, the prosperity of Duval, the welfare of Duval, because we want to honor Jeremiah 29. It's not just Duval. I know some of you live in Carnation and Monroe and across the valley and wherever you live, it's where you get to do it, right? Because we used to say in the early days of Redemption, Redemption Church exists wherever you live. Redemption Church exists wherever you work, wherever you're planted, right? That's how it plays. And so how do we do these things for the good of the city? Three quick points today. The first is this, based on kind of all that we've said and these three points that Keller brought up earlier, RC seeks to stand out from the norm, holy, be different, by loving our city neighbors indiscriminately. Indiscriminately. I choose that word on purpose because it means I'm not going to discriminate on who I say I love, I care about, I'm invested into, right? because the whole idea is saying, it doesn't matter who you are, what you think of me, Jesus calls me to love you. Just calls me to love you. That is the mission statement, right? And we love others around us because at the core, they bear the image of God. Every person, right? This is a hard one for us, I know, because we do kind of want to put things in moral strata, but I'm just telling you, every person, you think about the worst person you know or the worst person you've heard of, they still bear the image of God. They still do. This is because I always look and go, it's funny, Jesus loved us enough to come and die for us when he knew our real us. And so he's modeling, like, I knew you're real you and I loved you. I need you to love others, even if you know they're real them, because they bear my image still. I think that's a big challenge, but I think it's a beautiful calling as well. In Leviticus, we see the genesis of what it means to love your neighbor, because that's where it's born. In Leviticus chapter 19, he says, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against a fellow Israelite. We could say the same today. Do not bear a grudge or have revenge toward a fellow Christian, but love your neighbor as yourself. You're like, great, I can love my fellow Christian. But then he goes on in verse 33 and says, and do not take advantage of foreigners who live among you in your land. Treat them like native-born Israelites and love them as you love yourself. It's from this chapter in Leviticus that Jesus borrows and says, here's the greatest command. Love God, love your neighbor. When he says love your neighbor, he means both the insider and the outsider, the one that thinks like you and the one that thinks nothing like you, the one you identify as a brother or sister in faith and the one you might identify as opposed to, contrary to, different than your faith. You still have to love both, and love both the same. The same. Maybe not in the same way, but with the same sense of focus and intensity and care and passion and prayerfulness to love better. Like, that's what we're meant to do. I'll tell you why this is interesting to me. Honestly, the last few years have been crazy, right? And in that, with a lot of the political divide and friction and culture and everything else, I would see people that I love and I care about that would say, you know what, we're moving away. We're just sick of these liberals. Can't stand living in this liberal era anymore. I'm gonna go to another place where it's more conservative and the people are thinking like me and speaking like me and I can just live my life. And honestly, what I would really interpret from that is basically, I need to move away from these neighbors that I don't like to go find neighbors that I do like so I can more effectively love those neighbors. Because these neighbors that I don't like irritate me so much that I'm constantly irritated, and I'm not trying to figure out how to love them, I'm just frustrated by them. But if I went someplace else, I could love those people more easily and my life would be easier. Pastor Scott had this great analogy for this. He says, it's like there was fishermen at a lake full of fish, and they said, you know what? I'm sick of the fish. I'm gonna go find a lake with a bunch of fishermen and no fish, right? Because even though there's no fish to catch, I'll have a great time with all the fishermen. And there's a truth to that. Like, I think Jesus actually is like, go to uncomfortable places with people that make you uncomfortable and go and love them. Because that's even what he talks about. He's like, hey, you all love people that love you. You love the lovely of your life. He's like, great. The most pagan people in the world could do that. That's no miracle. He goes, but if you really want to get me excited and blow my mind and be just like me, go find those people that don't love you and love them. Go find those people that are opposed to you and do good to them. Go to those people that make fun of your faith. And those are the ones you want to try to figure out, how can I make an investment into to try to win their heart and win them to Jesus in some way? Like, how do I do that? See, that's the real challenge, right? But I think that's radical. This is what it means to truly be missional in our world. It means I'm gonna keep bringing the love of Jesus to you, and I'm gonna believe that that's gonna win you over one day. It's gonna win you over. That's the radical nature of Jesus. That's what he challenges us to. And so, man, we wanna love our city neighbors indiscriminately. Second, RC seeks to stand out from the norm by serving our city neighbors through tangible mercy. Right? Not just mercy as an idea, an ideology, but as a function, as a duty, as a practice, as something that is material. And at the end of this talk, I'm going to give two ways that we could do that, right? But for now, I just want to focus on the idea of it. And it's grounded in what we just saw, right? So there's this scene in Luke chapter 10 where, like, a scribe or religious leader has come to Jesus and said, hey, what's the greatest commandment? And he said, hey, love God, love your neighbor. And Jesus is like, that's right. And the guy's like, that's right. We agree on that. But then the person says, but who's my neighbor? Right? Like he's trying to figure out a way to maybe wiggle out. It can't be everybody's my neighbor. So Jesus tells a very familiar story. It says a Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho when he was attacked by bandits. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. By chance, a priest came along, a Jewish one. But when he saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and he passed him by. Next, a temple assistant, a Jewish one, right, walked over, looked at him lying there, but then also passed him on the other side of the road. You're like, that's cold, man. Yep, bleeding, you know, like, that's what he does. But then a despised Samaritan came along, and when he saw the man, a Jewish man, he felt compassion on him. Now here's the thing about the story that I think we miss sometimes, because it's always like the Good Samaritan, the story of the Good Samaritan, the story of the despised Good Samaritan. In other words, the Jewish dude lying in the road before he was beat up would not care for the Samaritan. He would be despised. All Jews despise the Samaritans, right? And the Samaritan is going to know, like, Jews don't like me. Jews hate me. Jews are against me. They oppose me. They think I'm less than, I'm dirt, I'm a dog, I'm a pig, whatever they think. So that's the setting. Here's a guy that comes across a guy that the guy laying there would hate the guy that is now over him feeling compassion, right? Now with that, the Samaritan could have done any number of things. It's like, you know what? These Jews, they hate us. He got what he had coming to him. Step over his body, keep walking. He could do that. Or they don't respect my kind, so why would I respect their kind? If I was bleeding and lying in the dirt, this guy wouldn't stop for me. Why should I stop for him? Here's why I bring this up. I think too often we read the story of the Good Samaritan, like, let's do good things for people that at least are going to appreciate what we're doing. But the story is about a guy doing something for another guy where the guy literally would hate the guy doing it. I'm sure if you asked the guy that got beat up that day before he got beat up, if you get beat up, would you want a Samaritan to care for you? He'd probably say, nope. I'd rather die than let that trash take care of me. Samaritan knows all of this, and yet he's going to do something anyway. And that's where, again, the challenge, I think, when it comes to, like, how do we bring mercy and love our city? We can't really look in terms of who likes us, who agrees with us, who's with our faith or against our faith. We can't look and go, oh, those are all the people on the Facebook message board that hate us. Would not be a good Samaritan to them. Get angry at them, frustrated at them, put out by them, irritated by that. Like, no, the good Samaritan is like, nah, that's not the thing. See, he felt compassion. And then, because it was tangible, he put it into action. It says, going over to him, he soothed his wounds, bandaged them, put the man on his own donkey, took care of him, handed him to the innkeeper, along with 2 silver coins to care for him. And then he said, hey, when I come back, I will pay you whatever is left on the tab when I return. Right? Mercy, ready? Here's the line for today. Mercy costs. Mercy costs. It's going to cost time. It's going to cost maybe energy. It might cost you reputation. Imagine what the other Samaritans thought about that Samaritan. You're helping that guy? Oh, I don't know if it's okay to help that guy. Cost you money, but mercy's worth it. And so Jesus says, basically, who's your neighbor? Even the person you don't care for and the person that doesn't care for you, that's your neighbor. Thus the story concludes. Now, which of these three would you say was the neighbor to the man who was attacked by the bandits? And the man replied, probably begrudgingly too, the one who showed him mercy. He doesn't even want to say the Samaritan. Notice that? The Jewish guy still doesn't want to say Samaritan. Oh, the nameless guy that showed him mercy. But then Jesus says, yes, that's all right. You got it. And now you got to go do it. You got to go do it, right? See, that's what we seek to do as a church. Right, we want to bring tangible mercy, and we want to love our neighbors, regardless of what they think of us. I mean, I think a lot of our neighbors like us. They get along with us. They may not believe what we believe, but there's a lot of good blood in this town. There's some people that don't care, don't like, right? And all the more, I go, that's the ones I want to go after. I really dig that. Like, honestly, there's a part of me that looks at, like, Christian obedience, and I'm like, read my Bible, pray, go to church, right? Don't cheat on my wife. Like, those, I barely see those as commands, man. Like, they are, but I'm like, they're so easy. It's not like work. I'm not suffering to do those things. Those just make sense to me. You want to know what's hard obedience? Love people that don't love me. care for an enemy that doesn't have a good opinion of me, go out of my way to try and make right with somebody that sees me wrong. Like, that's the tough stuff that Jesus asks us to do. And I think when we do things for the good of the city, it puts us in a place to be able to do that effectively. So we seek to do that. And then the third thing, RC seeks to stand out from the norm by serving our city neighbors through advancing justness. Now, I say justness, though technically what I'm talking about is justice, but even that's a little sad because I know there's been a lot of this like, oh, watch out for justice and social justice is bad. And I'm like, God really cares about justice a lot. It's like in the top five themes of the scripture of stuff that God's like, I care about this, right? And so we should care about this too. And it's important because, again, you have to understand when I say justness, I don't just simply mean law and order justness. As God would speak to it throughout the Hebrew scripture in particular, he's like, justness is worrying about the poor and the marginalized and the forgotten and the disempowered and people that are marginalized in some particular way. Like, that's what it was. And when God would get onto Israel, their two biggest offenses, they would follow false gods or they wouldn't exercise justice to the poor, the needy, and the marginalized, the widow and the orphan and things like that. They would just get all wrapped up in their own lives. And so God would be like, you got to get back on track. And so he'd rise up prophets to speak to it. And one prophet, Micah, says it this way, and I know we all love this passage, it's so good. He says, he has told you, O man, what is good, and what the Lord requires of you. What do you think it is? It's but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. I think those are so good. This, that triad is so good. Justice, kindness, and mercy. But notice it doesn't just say, hey, love justice. It says, do justice. A good explanation of what this looks like is from Bruce Waltke. He is an Old Testament scholar. He's written a ton of commentaries on the Old Testament. And he describes it this way. He says, the righteous or the just in this case, because tzaddik is a Hebrew word that can go, it means the same thing. Righteousness and justness is the same thing. So the righteous or the just are those who are willing to disadvantage themselves to advantage the community. The wicked are willing to disadvantage the community to instead advantage themselves. And so as a church, we go, well, we want to be exercising justness. And so we look at our community and we go, we want to give to it more than we take from it. We want to make sure that we're here for it more than we want it to be here for us. That we look and we go, we want to contend for its care, even if we may suffer some loss in the midst of that, because we want to advantage that, even if it disadvantages us, because we look and go, that seems to be a very much Jesus-like thing. So how do we invest that way? How do we give it away? Now, here's the thing I would say about this. There are all sorts of ways that you and I can do this. All sorts of ways. You can do it with your vocation. Because you may not realize this, but your job matters. Like, your job makes other people's jobs possible. It provides products or services or food or whatever to your community. So don't just look at your job as like, oh, I work and then I have my relationship with Jesus. No, your work is a kingdom thing. Your vocation matters. It's awesome. Or volunteerism, right? Your service matters. When you volunteer in our community, whatever context, you're doing this thing of doing things for the good of the city in Jesus' name, seeking its prosperity and its welfare and its care, and you can pray for the city as you're serving the city and doing that. It's awesome, right? Your advocacy matters because your voice is a way. You can do all of this. And so there's all sorts of ways that we can bring all of this to bear on our community. I want to just share two, all right? And one is going to be about time, and the other is going to be about treasure. Ways that we can make investment. When it comes to time, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but it's the Empower Youth Network. Has anybody heard of Empower Youth Network? Good, some of you have, that's awesome. So our very own Heather Downing is one of the directors there. And it was interesting, she came to me a couple of weeks ago after I gave my talk where I said, hey, when I was starting as a senior in high school, I had a 0.4 grade point average, right? And she's like, you had a 0.4? And I go, yeah, and she goes, and you turned out okay, you know? And I'm like, yeah, you know, I mean, not totally like that. She's way sweeter than I am. But that was kind of the thing. And she's like, you should become a mentor. And so, like, for youth, right, in our community. And so there's a bunch of things this particular organization does. But one is they are looking to find people, adults, to partner with kids, elementary through high school, to just meet with them for like 30 minutes to an hour once a week and just be a mentor. Just be a mentor. care about the kid, be interested in the kid, talk with the kid, understand their interests and wants. What a great way to do things for the good of the city in the name of Jesus with a tangible need. It's fantastic. And so one of the things we're putting together is just basically like a pipeline on in our material that says, hey, if you feel called to serve in the community, here's a great way to do it. Right? In the meantime, before we get all that up and running, maybe here's Heather's email address. It's also in the app notes. You can look at that and be like, man, I'm just going to reach out and go like, I could do a half an hour a week or an hour a week. I like kids. I know life is hard. I would love to come alongside a kid, right? Seeking the welfare of our community, especially for maybe some who are just kind of struggling, having a hard time. I know in my own life, there has been a couple of major mentors when I was younger. Tim Bullock, my baseball coach in elementary school, and Jim Harper, who was eventually my youth pastor. Those two men changed the trajectory of my world along with my wife, Ellen, right? They just changed my world. And so what a great opportunity to do that. So that's the first one. And that's just time, right? We just give our time. And they always have tons of like mentoring spots that they need kind of filled. And if you feel led to it, you could do it. Great way to love our city. The second one, and this one I want you to stop for a minute. I want to get your thinking in a certain sort of way. I want you to picture a moment where there's a child and they're living in this moment in time, this place of chaos. Something's going on with mom or dad or the live-in or the aunt that they live with. Something's very, very broken. There's just a lot of mess there. So much so that these people have suddenly come into your living space and you don't know what CPS quite means, but you know that something big is happening. And so there's a police officer and there's some other people and they take your little person and they take you outside and they say, we need to take you someplace different. I know this is really unsettling. We understand. And so they take this child and they put them into the back of a police car. I want you to have that scene right now. Capture that as you now watch this video right here.
I bet you're having a really hard time understanding everything that's happening to you right now. I know you might be scared, confused, and maybe even mad right now. It's okay to feel exactly what you are feeling. We hope watching this video will help you understand what's going to happen next and give you a good idea of where you're going right now. You are going to a house that is called Bridge Receiving Center. That is a big name for a place that's really just a house where you will be staying as you make this transition. We just call it Bridge. This house is designed especially for you and up to five other kids who are going through the same experience. Each of you will be staying here until your social worker finds the best place for you to stay while they figure out what's going to happen in your family. You could be here for a few days or even a little bit longer. There are some cool things about this special house, and I'd like to show them to you now. As we pull up to the house, you will notice a big fence with a big gate surrounding the house. This fence is to make you feel safe while you are here. While your social worker talks to some of the helpers at Bridge, you will be taken on a tour of the house. You may have noticed the large dining room table. This is here because eating together is one of the most important things we will do here. You will be joining other children at the house and the helpers who make your dinner and share your meals with you. You don't have to worry about getting food here because we will always have food for you. Let me show you the pantry that will always be stocked with food. No one will ever go hungry at Bridge. We will share meals, but if you get hungry and it's not mealtime, there will always be food and other snacks that we will keep out just for you. Food is not something you ever have to worry about at Bridge. I bet that while we are looking at the kitchen, you are noticing the large room in the back of the house. This is a room that we built just for the kids at Bridge. We have games, puzzles, toys, and crafts. And yes, of course, we have a TV. We will even have movie nights with popcorn in the playroom. Let's go check out the bedrooms and bathrooms, since these are important rooms too. You will share the house with other kids who are new at Bridge, just like you. You will have your own bed, your own cubby, and a place to put your clothes and anything special you were able to bring with you. You may not have been able to bring anything with you, but that's just fine too, because we have pajamas, toothbrushes, clothes, and everything you need right here at Bridge. Let's look outside and check out the yard. You will see there are lots of fun things to do out here. We have play equipment, a sport court, ping pong table, bikes, and other fun games. Another special part of Bridge is that it's actually part of a children's camp. When you are staying at Bridge, you will be able to go to the camp and do fun activities like the jumping pillow, the climbing wall, climb in the trees, and play in the huge indoor gym. Here are some of the faces of people you might see at Bridge that are here to help you. We are so excited to meet you, and we look forward to getting to know you while you are here with us. We know this is a hard experience for you, and we want to make it better. Please let us know how we can help you feel safe and comfortable during your time at Bridge.
So right now I want to bring up my friend Tracy, who is the director at Bridge, and as she's coming up, I want to let you know, because I know some of you are so conscientious and thoughtful, that all of the children in that video were actually children of staff members, so you're not like, wow, they're putting a video together of kids that are, no, that's not the case. They're very conscientious about the safety of all the children that get brought into the program, but we have been partnered with Bridge actually for a handful of years, and so even in the video there was that trail, and we actually took one Sunday off as a church to go and help put in that trail and bark it and everything else, and maybe we need to do some touch-up. I don't know. We're going to find out. But that was an awesome Sunday. We had like 150 people from Redemption show up to that. It was just really, really cool. But the other thing we have done in the last year is we've kind of adopted Bridge Receiving as a part of a ministry that we want to support, an outing that we want to support. And so we give about $10,000 a year to Bridge. And so Tracy and I were just talking this morning about the fact that she's like, was that a one-time thing? I'm like, no, that's going to be an annual thing from us. And so she just found out today, like, all right, another $10,000. That's awesome, right? So, and that's all of you given, by the way. So that's awesome. Thank you for that. But I just wanted to have Tracy up for a minute. She's going to be at a table outside as well. I'm going to encourage all of you to head that way and talk to her if this is an area that you go like, I care about this. This is on my heart. But we just wanted to have a chance to hear from you. Some of us know about Bridge, but why don't you just, if you crushed it down into a nut, what would you say is really the essence and heart of what it does?
Well, the essence and heart of what Bridge does is provide a safe place for children when home isn't safe for them. But really, if you're doing the speak of the organization, we're a therapeutic transitional residential facility for children ages 4 to 17 years old who've been removed from home due to abuse or neglect for the very first time. So these aren't kids that have been in the system for a long time. This is brand new, like Matt told you. Immediately from the time the police pick them up, they come to Bridge. The majority of them come to us. We've never had a child come before 11 o'clock at night. The majority of them are 2 or 3 in the morning after the worst day of their life and not understanding what's going on. And so really what Bridge is all about in a nutshell is trying to provide trauma care more than anything. So trauma care to traumatize children. The current system was traumatizing them further by bouncing them around, not giving them any stability, not helping them understand what's going on. And so we're trying to help them to stabilize, to deal with the trauma. They say that trauma isn't what you go through, it's being alone and not being understood in what you go through. And so at Bridge, we are there to say we understand what you've been through. We are here to help you through it every step of the way and to give you resources and support and love. And more than anything, we've cared for 229 children. You all have provided 4,730 safe nights to children since we opened 4 years ago. But clap for that. That's amazing. From 11 counties in Washington State, but the vast majority come from Snohomish and King County. Malnourished children, the reason that video talks about food all the time, we have a little boy that just left our care, had to have a feeding tube. He was so malnourished from mistreatment at home. So children that have really been in the hardest place, and we are there to help meet them in their need, put them back on their feet. But every one of those children have said, I must have done something wrong that the police came and took me today. Every single one of them said, what did I do today that changed it? They don't understand. And can you imagine a child like that being taken into a foster home, which is a beautiful thing, but a home that doesn't understand what happened to that child, where there's other children there, where life seems normal and happy? That's just that actually further traumatizes them without first dealing with that initial shock of what's going on. So sorry, that's more than a nutshell.
I loved it. That was better than a nutshell. I mean, it had joy and sadness and truth all wrapped into one. I love that. So, and also just as a clarifier, because I know some people may be less aware, like what also makes Bridge different is that at least it used to be like a child would be taken from the home and there was like 3 days to find a place where you all give room.
Yes.
For more, like it's up to 30 days, right?
Actually longer.
Longer now, that's awesome. Yeah. So what, just a little bit highlight that, because I think the ability to kind of station, you know, get them a little bit more stationary in their emotions and their trauma is really pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So.
There are a lot of places that do 3 days. 3 days are because the courts have 72 hours to prove their case, whether that child stays out or goes back home. But Bridge wanted to do it differently because we know it takes a lot longer than 72 hours to help a child understand what's going on in their life and start to stabilize. So we take children for 30 to 60 days or longer. Little boy just came to us. Well, he just left our care. He was with us for 74 days. The worst case of sensory deprivation. I can't tell you what place he was put in, but you can imagine a place with no stimulus from the outside world. And he couldn't eat, couldn't stand, couldn't care for himself. That little boy needs a lot more than 72 hours to be processed. So he was with us for 74 days. The longest child has stayed with us 113 days. Wow. So doing what we can, have a lot of specialists on site. Every single child that's come to us has been illiterate. These are 4 to 16, because we haven't had a 17-year-old yet. Children being passed from school to school to school, can't read, can't write. Most of them don't understand what's going on. Lots of abuse. We had a little boy that had never taken a bath before after he had been abused in a bathtub and couldn't actually face taking a bath. So our staff sat outside. He asked if we'd sit outside the door while he took a bath. So imagine just trying to help rebuild children who have no sense of their value and worth. And that's really more than anything. I mean, that's the gospel right there, is to help people understand their value and worth. And children automatically assume it's their fault. So that's really what we're doing at Bridge. And we're taking all the time we can that the state allows. So sometimes the state says it's time to send them back, or it's time to send them to this other place. And then we step in and say, we're going to get you ready. A, you know you're worth so much more than you were treated. That will never leave you. That we want you to hang on to. And now we're going to get you ready for where you're going. And so we do start to do the work, whether they want to go where they're going or not, whether it's where we recommend them to go or not, we help prepare them. And then we have now a parent partner program. When they go back home with mom or dad, we have a parent partner that can go with them and go into the home, because we didn't used to be able to do that. We had to figure out how to make that happen. So now we have someone that goes with them and helps keep eyes on them, and also helps mom and dad understand their own trauma, because the vast majority of the parents of these children were traumatized children themselves that didn't have their trauma dealt with. So,
Thank you for that. So here's my encouragement. It's interesting, in James 1, it talks about pure or true religion is this, to care for widows and orphans in their time of need. Like, this is the purest form. Man, you got...
I know, me too. Me too.
So... pull it in, Matt. All right. So with that, though, I'm just going to pray and close this up here, really, in a lot of ways. But here's the thing that's really needed by Bridge receiving at this point. I'm sure a lot of you are like, I want to go and love those kids. That you can't not do because there's too many requirements and too many.
I mean, they could, but it's very complicated.
It's a complicated process.
Very
so
complicated.
You would have to go through a lot if you feel led to that. But again, if you look in our notes today, Tracy's email, or at least the email address to Bridge Receiving, is there for those who want to give or volunteer. So you could start a process if you want to do that. I love if that's your heart. But what they really do need is finances in a lot of ways. And so, you know, they just recently went through some budget stuff. They're looking at the numbers. They need some infusion right now. And so, honestly, if you're like, hey, I feel led to this, I feel like this is something I could help with, whether it be monthly or a gift or whatever it is, would you... honestly, please, just as soon as I say amen, just go right out to Tracy at the table and talk to her. I told her, I'm like, what can I most serve you with today? Because you're serving kids that have so much going on. And she's like, well, here's our challenge right now. So I'm just like, hey, man, I'm making this appeal. If it's something you feel led to, it's something you have resource, please go talk to Tracy. Again, as a church, we do it out of our budget as well. But every individual that can be a part of that and continue in that in some way or whatever it might be, that would be really, really fantastic. And so again, just a great way to do things for the good of the city, because again, gospel neighboring and gospel messaging are both critical to us. And so I'm just going to keep Tracy up here to pray over her, pray over Bridge Receiving, and then cut you all loose to whatever Jesus is calling you to do. And so Jesus, I just thank you for my friend Tracy and just her heart, her love. I thank you that she has done something that many people will think about but maybe not try to execute. And she spent years figuring out how to do it, to rally resources, to find people, to get donations, to do something, to move it from just an idea to an implemented beautiful reality for children. And so I pray for her and her stamina in doing that. I pray for all of the people that work at Bridge Receiving to do that as well. For the children, man, let the little children come to me. May that be a place where you are felt in really bold ways. And for all of us that feel led or pulled in some direction to this, may we not just go, hey, that's an idea I like, but man, may we implement it too. May they reach their budget, surpass their budget, be able to serve more children in this way and bring not just food and shelter and clothing, but soul healing, right? Real soul healing to these kids. And so Jesus, we love you and we thank you. We certainly need you and praise you in your good name. Amen. Would you give Tracy a big round of applause?
Thank you.
Thank you, sweet lady. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate that.